Welcome to another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. New York-based fashion designer Rachel Antonoff is multi-talented. She's hip, she's funny, she's smart, irreverent, committed to social causes, and most impressive of all, is just 32. Antonoff began her career as a writer, contributing articles to publications like Lula Magazine, Nylon, Black Book, and Teen Vogue. The writing gave way to her first fashion line, Mooka Kinney, in 2005, named after her dog. The indie line disbanded in 2008, and then 2 years later, she launched Rachel Antonoff. In its first season, the line had wall displays at Barney's New York and can now be found in that store, Stephen Allen, Revolve, and boutiques around the United States and in Japan. Footwear soon followed clothing. In spring of 2011, the Bass Loves Rachel Antonoff collection was born. Her clothes and her shoes have a lot in common. They're retro, whimsical, comfortable, with a style all their own. Rachel, welcome.
Hi.
So when did you realize that you had a real fashion sense?
Well, you know, it's weird because growing up, like every child, I think I was one of those kids who wanted to do everything and still kind of do. You know, there's just like a million things that I think. I watch Grey's Anatomy and think, oh, I wonder if I should be a surgeon. But I never considered designing. It's just not one of the things that was on my list. And I didn't realize until later that I was actually always doing it without knowing it.
Meaning what?
Well, I've always had these really elaborate daydreams, probably, again, like most people. And I didn't realize until I started doing this that the star of all of these daydreams were the clothes. So, you know, it would usually be me in some kind of fun scenario where a boy from school liked me or whatever. But I looked fabulous.
And in your dreams?
In the daydreams, yes. Uh-huh. I looked, you know, I'm a little taller, my teeth are a little whiter, whatever. But I'm wearing these what I thought to be incredible outfits, and that's now still how I design. I run in the park, I let it go, and then when I see one of these outfits, I stop and I write it down in my phone.
So what you were conjuring up in your head, you weren't seeing anywhere else, right?
No, exactly.
So were these really out there?
No,
were
it was just
silly designs, kind of like if you actually wore something like that, would people stop and say, what does she have on?
No, not the opposite, because for some awful self-involved reason, all of these daydreams have always revolved around some guy liking me, which is so silly. And so it's just me in whatever my mind feels I would look the best in.
So it didn't necessarily mean that it was sexy or provocative?
No, because that's really not my thing.
What is your thing?
I think my thing is as comfortable as possible without looking like you've left your house in sweats.
Like a frump.
Yes, exactly. I really value comfort, and I think some of it is actually railing against some of the silly aspects of fashion, how, you know, fashion is an art like any art, mm-hmm. and for some reason I think it's one of the only creative industries that's viewed as really fluffy and really silly sometimes. There's always a part of me that feels really sort of disenfranchised from this industry and, you know, not like I've always sort of not fit in and not sure I even want to. And to me, obviously, clothes have a functionality. We need to cover certain private parts, and we need to stay warm, mm-hmm. or we need to stay cool. Mm-hmm. But also, I just think clothes should be fun, and they shouldn't be prohibitive of, you know, I can't have a normal day or have a good time because I can't move my arm in this bizarre piece.
Right, right, right.
I just think they should be fun and silly and things to have fun adventures in.
Well, the interesting thing is that you're dubbed an indie designer. What does it mean to be an indie designer?
You know, I'm not really sure. I mean, sometimes I think it's just that divide between people who sell in small stores versus big stores or people who kind of think outside the box.
So when did you actually realize, take this out of your mm-hmm. daydreams and put it really out there? How old were you and how did you start?
Right. I was about 24 years old. Which I think for most people is an age where you kind of have an idea of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was interesting to be surprised at that age, you know, with this whole new career. But I was writing and trying to be a full-time writer.
What did you want to write?
I wanted to write nonfiction essays.
Essays, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to do that. And I had previously worked in fashion in PR okay. for another designer, which was an interesting experience. But when I left, I think I said out loud, I will never work in fashion again, which I sort of find amusing now.
Never say never.
Never say never. So I had this roommate, Allison Lewis, and we just loved clothes. And I had this big closet, and we combined all of our dresses in there. And it was summer, and we would go out every night and just put on dresses and kind of walk around the neighborhood and just, I don't know, it was just a really magical summer. And we would talk all the time about clothes we wished we had. I wish I had a dress like this, or wouldn't it be so cute if there was a pocket like that? And this is the only part I don't remember, which is what made us go from talking about it to doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, recently I decided maybe I should be a puppeteer, and that's probably not going to happen. But for whatever reason, this was one of those things that it just happened. So I had a neighbor, a childhood neighbor in New Jersey, Marlene Sapoff, who is just an excellent seamstress. And so for whatever reason, we went out, we bought fabric, and we made some sketches, and we brought them to Marlene Sapoff. And she made us three samples. And we went and saw the samples, and it was just really bizarre and exciting and surreal to see these things that had started as ideas and now were tangible things. And then what happened next was just a really crazy stream of events that now I know is very atypical. But at the time, I just thought, this is fun and interesting, which is that we took pictures of each other in the dresses. We emailed them to a few random editors at different magazines. And Jane,
Cold.
Cold. Mm-hmm. Like, so green, which is why I really advocate for – I think education is fabulous. But I also really advocate for just doing, because had I intended to do all of this, I would have known that the way we handled things was mortifying, and I wouldn't have done it.
This was really ballsy, what you did, in other words.
Ballsy and stupid and, like, just incredibly naive.
Okay.
So the wonderful Jane Keltner at Teen Vogue wrote me back, and she called us into her office, you know, to see the three samples, and we showed her, and she said she was going to write a story about us, which at the time there was no us. We were two girls with different jobs who had somebody sew three samples.
So this was almost like a hobby. Well, or
not even yet. It was like a nothing.
A whim?
It would be like if I did decide to become a puppeteer this week, took one class, some famous puppeteer agent was like, you've got it, you know?
Okay.
And then suddenly I was like a real puppeteer. It was kind of like a nightmare.
Your daydreams turned into a nightmare.
Yes. So she wrote about us, and then she called the Barney's buyer, Megan Mitchell, from her office and just set up an appointment for us. And it's not like we didn't know this was exciting. We were excited. I just don't think we knew that this was unheard of.
Really?
So it was a real side door, not even. It was like a side window entrance to this industry that we both knew very little about. And so then we met with Barney's. She placed an order for 300 units.
Well, you had three dresses. Where did you get the other 297?
Well, we had like 2 months to make them. And it's now, I mean, looking back on this, it's so silly because we thought, Marlene Sapoff can't sew 300 dresses.
I was just going to say, poor Marlene, if, you know, she's not answering her phone.
Right. But the idea that we even thought that one person could do this. Plus, we did have one order that we filled before Barney's. It was for a small boutique called iHeart. And she ordered 16 dresses. And it took Marlene Sapoff the entire summer to sew them, first of all. Second of all, we wholesaled the dresses to iHeart for $100.
You mean all 16?
No, per dress.
$100 per dress, right. Okay.
But per dress to Marlene, we paid her $125. So our margin was bad.
I'm not the sharpest math person around, but I'm getting this too.
It wasn't the best. And we thought, what a bargain. We only have to pay $25 per dress to be in a real store.
Yeah, I got it.
So we had a lot to learn. And it felt a lot like one of those anxiety dreams where you didn't know that the final was that day, or you're in the circus and you don't know what you're doing. And so for me, Mooka Kinney, the 3 years we did that, was my education.
So that was the line.
Mm-hmm.
You decided to call these three dresses mm-hmm. that started it all Mooka Kinney.
Yes.
And that's how the line was born.
Yes.
But at some point along the road, mm-hmm. you had to get professional advice, whether it be from your parents. You just couldn't keep, you know, doing it this way.
No. We had to stop for Barney's because, you know, we needed a factory. And we had been going to Mood Fabrics, That's where we were getting our fabrics. And we just—
Mood Fabric, is that a famous name in New York?
They're like one of the biggest retail stores, which is, by the way, you know, nobody—
Buys retail?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We didn't figure that out for years. But that was another, you know, we would have to, we'd sell a dress to Barney's with a certain fabric, and then they'd say, we want this many, and then we'd have to go back to Mood, and they'd be like, but we have 2 yards because we're a retail store. So it's just, you know, we had no idea what we were doing. But they, people who worked there kind of gave us advice, like, call this guy, and that guy said, call this guy. So we found, we sort of sniffed out factories and pattern makers, and it was really stressful.
And it was really just the two of you.
It was just the two of us.
Your parents, her parents, nobody else kind of—
Well, my father has been integral, never know.
Mm-hmm.
Which is it?
It's integral.
Great.
He was very helpful, my dad.
Since the beginning, yeah. Very helpful. And now he's my partner.
Okay.
We
so he's
officially
the, he's
work
the,
together.
The business
yeah.
brains of this.
He's the way I liken him to a human being standing on the ground firmly, and I'm a balloon that he's like holding on to.
So you won't fly
threatening
away.
To fly away, exactly.
Okay.
So he's been, you know, very involved since the beginning and very helpful and, you know, lent us money and just was really great.
So today, Rachel Antonoff, to mm-hmm. sort of jump forward a little bit, employs how many people?
We employ full-time one person.
Other than you?
Other than me.
And what does that other person do?
Well, because she's just one other person, she does everything. And she, I need to call her out because she's the favorite person in the entire world. Her name's Sarah Lopez.
Uh-huh.
She is the greatest. Her technical title is executive assistant, but really she's like the president of the world in my life.
And she gets it all.
With her.
So yeah. you're the creative mm-hmm. brains in this, where your dad's the business brains.
Right.
And Sarah.
Yeah.
Is
she handles things.
She's kind of, how about this, the nervous system?
That
if
is,
you're, if you're
yes.
the, you know, if somebody's the heart and somebody else is, mm-hmm. you know, the stomach or whatever.
Right. That's exactly right. And then she also is a little bit of the heart and the stomach.
So you.
She's just an all-around game improver.
So where are you today in 2013 after your company was launched in 2010? So 3 years.
Okay.
Kind of a. Just encapsulate those three
right.
years.
So, well, things have changed a lot. The first season, I remember, it felt terrifying to be on my own in the beginning. And now, well, now I don't feel like I'm on my own. But mm-hmm. it does feel fine and good. And I remember going to Barney's to see the first season. And it was like I had no concept of – I was so against, you know, what I thought were the constructs of the fashion industry – that I went really far in the other direction and said, I'm going to know nothing. I'm going to do this the way I want to do it. I'm not going to adhere to any of these, you know, typical guidelines. But some of those guidelines are there for a reason. Like, this is what makes a well-rounded collection, which is, you know, that you don't use 10 different crazy clashing florals in the same collection. So
right.
that was sort of interesting and might have even seemed like a choice for the first season. But it was actually just random. And then when I went to Barney's to see it, it looked like a horrible garden that nobody had weeded, you know, or like taken care of in 10 years.
Were they all – those were just dresses.
Those
were
yeah.
Those were the 300 from the 16 dresses?
No, that was my first season on my own.
Right.
So, you know, now we've expanded to different categories. We do pants and jackets.
It's eclectic in a positive way, meaning mm-hmm. that you have dresses that you can wear at night. You mm-hmm. also do sweatshirts.
Mm-hmm. That was an exciting development.
Yeah. The comfortable clothes. I mean, it's so
yeah.
funny to me, you know, to say something, yes, I design sweatshirts. Does that seem strange?
It does. I started it as a joke and then people really liked them. And they're also at a really friendly price point. So, yeah, I started designing, as I said, because it was things I wanted to wear and things I saw myself wearing. And then at some point, I guess it's just a part of getting older, those two paths went a little bit separate from each other because I do want to be in sweats. And I think like any job, once it becomes a real career, it takes a little bit of that personal fun out of it. Like I don't want to frolic around the West Village in cute dresses anymore. I want to mm-hmm. be in my bed in my comfy clothes doing my work.
Do you think – designers, obviously, not mm-hmm. male designers who, you know, design for women. But does Donna Karan wear her clothes?
I don't know. I feel like that's one of those things that's really personal. I do wear a lot of our clothes partly because it's what I own. You know, I can't remember the last time I went out and bought something.
Well, it's less expensive for you, I suppose.
Yeah. You know, it's – I don't as much subscribe anymore to the whole it's good advertising, because if I need to rely on that, then that's an issue. But I do like what I design, you know, love in some cases, so that's good. But a lot of it is just more – what's the word? Fancy than I would want to wear.
Who's your target audience?
That's something that we're – is an ever-evolving, attempting-to-figure-out process.
Because clearly I'm not wearing your dresses.
But you could. I think you could.
I wouldn't look silly in them.
I do not think you would look silly in them. I feel like that's – I don't know if you saw the Kmart video we did recently. It's we did a Money Can't Buy style video for Kmart, and I felt really proud of it because the theme was style through the ages, and my models were Sarah, my assistant, my mother, and my grandmother modeling my clothes, and then one staple piece from Kmart.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt really special and kind of what it encapsulated what I've been trying to say about the clothes, that my grandmother can wear this blouse and my mom can wear that dress and there's something for everybody. But that's not a focused business.
Because that would kind of make you make one all over the place.
Right, exactly.
That would be too hard, I would think, right?
Our biggest issue is that our target audience can't afford our clothes. Because I think I can't afford our clothes.
I was just going to ask. So really, what is that? 18 to what?
I think it's late teens to mid 30s.
And because your clothes, I mean, for people who don't know, Barney's is a really Tony store.
I mean, even just for us producing in America, it is incredible. You know, people pick up clothing in Barney's and say, God, this is so offensively expensive. When really, I'm sure whoever is designing it is barely even making a margin.
Well, back up. Mm-hmm. Making my clothes in America, so your factories are here.
Well, yes, until now. So I don't want – you know, we had to move. So now we're in India and China, but this is the first season we're doing that.
And it just became too
difficult. It's just
difficult.
Unaffordable. It's outrageous. I mean, the prices here and there, and we are working with – fair wage, you know, good factories there. It's just an astronomical difference. And so it's not even a matter of us making a margin. It's a matter of making fashion affordable. I don't think it's appropriate for a silk blouse to retail for $375. I just don't.
But that's what you would charge or the store would charge if the blouse was made here.
Exactly.
So give me the comparison now that it's made overseas. That same $375 blouse.
That same $375 blouse will now be $175, $200, which, by the way, also a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I go into J. Crew and see a $75 sweater and think that's a lot of money.
Right.
So that's the issue, is that I think it is – young people with regular jobs who are our target demographic, I think it's me. And the fact that I couldn't – once I went to Barney's and saw a pair of our shorts, mm-hmm. that we had only produced enough to fill the Barney's order because there wasn't enough fabric. And I thought, oh, it'd be funny if I tried them on. So I did. And then I loved them so much that
don't
I
tell
thought –
you bought them.
I bought them. I mean, this was, I think – my father has been dismayed and shocked and disappointed by a lot of my actions, but this one might have been the biggest.
That should be a secret.
And, you know, I also thought, oh, wouldn't that be a nice sort of like action of solidarity with us and maybe even like a little good luck? It was crazy.
How much were the shorts?
Here's the point.
Well, wait.
It,
how
like,
much were the
broke
shorts?
Broke the bank. They were, I think they were, oh, God, like $315.
Holy cow.
It stressed me out for weeks, not to divulge
why did
too
you
much.
Return them?
Well, first of all, when I gave them my credit card, the person looked at me like, are you psychotic?
That's
she was like, is this a coincidence? And, you know, whatever their policy is, it's fine, I'm sure. But they don't give vendor discounts, which I've always found a little disappointing.
They don't have to.
They don't have to. And so, you know, it was just really – it was one of those things that, you know, when you're about to shut the car door on your fingers, you see it happening.
But you can't
and you
stop.
Can't stop.
But
that was it.
That really hurts when you do that.
And yeah, as did this. So it's just – I don't want it to be the case that people can't afford our clothes or that the clothes seem in any way elitist. I just don't want that. So yeah, we're working on that.
You design dresses, mm-hmm. tops, bottoms, and accessories?
Some.
What don't you design clothing-wise? Right.
Clothing-wise, let's see. We don't do a lot of outerwear.
Okay.
We do one or two coats per season. We don't do a lot of knits. We do maybe one sweater per season, but that's not really...
Are your clothes strictly summertime clothing?
Both.
Or, so they're year-round.
Yeah. We do two collections a year instead of the four that people typically do. So we do fall, winter, and then spring, summer.
Mm-hmm. Are you making money?
Yes, but, not enough.
It's a bit of a slog.
Mm-hmm.
But you can – if you were a seer – you could see down the road that you should stay on this path. Maybe
yes.
Not buy your own shorts, but.
Right, exactly. There is a clear cut path that we can see that leads towards making more money.
Making this very viable.
Yes. I want this to be a viable, strong company that if they would want, I could one day pass down to my children. That's where I see this going.
Speaking about passing down, now let's move to the shoes. How is that marriage made?
That marriage was made in another really, I hate this word, but organic, strange way that in hindsight I now know is atypical, which is that – so the people at Bass, which is owned by Harbor Footwear, are wonderful, nice, kind people, which I feel like is not always, around in business. And we were working with them because we were borrowing their shoes, their saddle shoes, for our shows. So their PR person, Lisa Wright, a wonderful person – I was in contact with her just about logistics for getting the shoes, et cetera. And I genuinely cannot remember, again, how the conversation started. But, maybe I said, if you guys ever want to talk about working together, that would be fun. And she said, oh, that would be fun. There was some kind of very casual, laid-back
offhanded
conversation. Yeah. I think I remember even, being in a car while just typing this on my BlackBerry.
I hope
so
you weren't
driving. Not a big deal. I actually wasn't this time. But and I had had similar conversations with other shoe companies that, ended up just kind of being smoke and nothing. And so I went in for a meeting with them, and it was just very legitimate. It was real business people, and they had thoughts and things to say and ideas, and I had the same. And I left feeling really excited and then actually sort of nervous to possibly lose this thing that I didn't even think was real in the first place. And then it just progressed, and it was.
Were you nervous about designing shoes? Because that's a whole other ballgame.
Yes.
Did you think, how do I know what I'm doing?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm nervous about everything, first of all day, which
yes,
is a separate thing.
Yes, but apparently that doesn't retard you.
Well, something I've learned, which I hope is true, is that I'm pretty sure everybody occasionally / often feels like a fraud, I hope. I don't know.
Yes. Well, I can certainly attest to that.
Okay, good. When I've asked around, it seems like that is the case. When you look at someone and they seem really successful, they still sometimes feel like a fraud. And so – and I think I am heading in the right direction because I feel like less and less of a fraud as I get older. So that's good. But yeah, our first meeting for the shoes, I was so nervous. And – they were just the loveliest, best people.
So they kind of held your hand a little bit.
Big time.
Short of the fact that what you had in common was that you wear shoes.
Right, exactly. But that's, I applied the same rule to it that I did in the beginning with the clothes, which is I have ideas. And if I like these things, then chances are there's some other people out there who will too. I actually worked with a designer I feel like I should mention. Anita De Silva is the main Bass designer, and she's just incredible. We worked as a pair fully. So that was really fun and not scary. But yeah, it's been 7 seasons with them, which is a lot for a collaboration. And it's just been a real pleasure.
Who came up with the name Bass Loves Rachel Antonoff? That's very impressive.
Thanks. I don't remember. I don't think it was me because that seems really egomaniacal. I think it started as Bass Hearts Rachel Antonoff, and then someone else said – loves.
Enough with the hearts.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not that. That's another thing with fashion. The cutesy language, to me, there's something that I'm trying to figure out what it is and write it down actually right now. But there's something that feels really not feminist about it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Not to go too off topic, but I have such an issue with this phrase that is constantly used, girl crush. Do you know this?
No.
It's like. Well, it's the most heteronormative thing ever because what it's saying is if you have a girl crush on someone, you're a straight girl with, a friend crush on another girl.
Okay. Maybe I have heard that expression.
But it completely discounts just the fact that there's girls who have actual crushes on other girls. And I'm not describing it well, but it really irritates me.
it's a little diabetes producing as well as patronizing.
Exactly.
Maybe.
And I don't know why girls and women and women's magazines feel the need to do this sort of cutesifying of language that you see in – I just don't think men write emails to each other that start with men. You know what I mean? Like, I don't like receiving emails that from work people that start with, hey, lady, or ladies, or – what was one? I got one recently that really bothered me. Just something like, hey, lady friend. And it's like, we don't have to do this. We can talk to each other like people and adults. And then other people will take us more seriously and maybe someday pay us the same as those other people who get more than us.
Mm-hmm.
Not to sound too angry. But
do you worry that people were not taking you seriously or dragging you into that hole, so to speak?
Sometimes, because I think when you exist in that world and, you know, let's say I'm doing an interview with some fashion something, it's like – that's the verbiage, and it's hard not to play into it sometimes, especially when you know it's – like recently in an interview I was asked something like, how do you define fashion – what it means to be a fashionista? And I felt like an asshole, but I had to say I don't know because that word gives me a case of the douche chills. And you know what I mean? Fashionista and – I don't know. Let's just say I love that shirt. Can't we just say that? Does it have to be like street style alert? You know, I don't know. I just don't think that men or men's magazines are saying cutesy things like that.
I got you. And I agree with you because I certainly am not a fashionista, but that would never stop me from saying I got to get those shoes because I'm crazy about
right.
them. And whether I'm making a fashion statement or not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the likelihood is I'm not making a fashion statement because I don't own a pair of shoes with heels that are over half an inch.
I don't know if you noticed, but I'm wearing sneakers, which I wear every day with whatever outfit. Because
they are pretty neon.
They are. I hate them, but someone gave them to me, so –
you know, with this kind of politicizing mm-hmm. a little bit, that leads into your activism. Why don't you talk to us about that, you're pretty political?
So, well, my brother Jack and I for a really long time had been talking about, you know, we always talk about equality specifically with LGBTQ right now, what's happening. And
any personal reasons for that?
Why no.
that's a cause for either one of you?
No personal reasons. I can't say why that over anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something I've always wondered and thought about is why is one thing somebody's cause and another thing isn't? And I think the conclusion is just if we really – if we allowed our hearts to bleed for every horrible atrocity that happens in the world, we would just – die.
That's right. That's right. Doesn't mean that you're not against fracking.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I hate animal cruelty, and I'm very upset about what's happening in many countries all over the place.
But you're
I
just
actually,
one person.
I did reach a point a while ago where I was feeling so intensely angry about a lot of issues specifically relating to inequality that I think I started to sound like a crazy angry person. And, you know, it was getting to the point – I feel like we talked about this a little – where – you know, a man would hold a door for me and I would be thinking like, fuck you, I can hold the door for myself. And that's not productive.
Uh-huh.
So I had to relax a little bit. But anyway, Jack and I had been talking about this for years and years and, you know, starting something or doing a benefit concert or just what we could do. And then Fun, his band.
You should just reference who your brother is.
So my brother Jack is a great person, and he's been a musician for almost his whole life, and he's started a band with two other guys called Fun with Nate Roos and Andrew Doss.
And they're Grammy-winning, and they're
yes.
all over the place.
They're Grammy-winning. Yes. I mean, it's been a really exciting year for them, and it's
mm-hmm.
just the best.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. But they were already doing something really phenomenal, which was that they were donating $1 from every ticket sale to different LGBTQ organizations. And I don't have all the facts exactly straight, but what happened, I think, was that logistically and for tax reasons, it didn't make sense for them to not have their own organization. So, you know, I know very little about all of that, but that's what I gathered.
Apparently, well, all we have to do is ask your father, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Their business people said businessy stuff, and it made sense that they needed to have their own organization.
Mm-hmm.
And then because Jack and I had been talking about something similar for a long time, we thought, you know, maybe we
join
merge
forces.
This idea exactly and do it together, which I had some reservations about, and as it turns out, they were totally nullified. It's been really cool. We have this.
So what's the name of the organization?
The organization is called the Ally Coalition.
Ally?
Ally, yes. Because, you know, it's really about the role that a straight person plays as an ally to this issue.
And it's been around for how long?
It has been around for less than a year, which means that we are really still finding our footing, figuring out what we're doing. Where does this money go? What's happening? Because nobody wants to give money to an organization that's simply funneling it into other organizations. So we're kind of feeling out really specifically what can we do, what we're about. And as of right now, it seems that it's heading in the direction of shelters for young LGBTQ people who, you know, have been forced to leave their homes.
Right.
And
despite all the changes that have happened in this country with DOMA and the Supreme Court decision, mm-hmm. We still have a long way to go.
Such a long way to go. So, yeah, it's nice to feel like we can do something, because I think that's the worst thing, is just feeling so powerless.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we feel like is the biggest issue facing this issue is apathy, because we know there's the nut jobs who are full of hate. We all know that. And then, of course, we know that there's the supporters, and that's great. But there's so many people who just kind of don't care. And I get it.
They're not impacted by this. Why should they give a damn?
And that's, you know, the whole thing has always reminded me of that poem about the Holocaust, which I shouldn't have referenced because I don't know the name or the author. It's the one like, you know, first they came for this group, but I wasn't this group, so
right.
I looked the other way. And
right.
then, and then, and then. And then at the end, you know, and then they came for me, and I looked around for help, and nobody was left. So we strongly feel that this is not specifically a gay issue. This is a human issue. There are, you know, in our time now, there are many, many people, our neighbors, our friends, our brothers, our sisters, whatever, who literally don't have the same rights as us. And that's, when you really think about it, it's bananas.
In 2013.
Yes, it's just outrageous. So the fact that it's LGBTQ people, that's just a fact. It could be any group of people. So I think that it's really important that this is something to be outraged about. But like we just said, there are so many things to be outraged about, and only enough time and energy to be outraged, you know, besides eating and working. So what are you going to do?
You've done plenty.
Thanks.
Rachel, it has been fabulous talking with you.
Oh, we're done?
You really are.
This is so
multi-layered
fun.
And funky and I don't mean that to sound patronizing, but
are
just
you kidding?
Delightful.
I'm eating it up. I love it.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.